Tēnā koutou katoa and hello everybody. Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. My name is Ben Adelberg and I'm coming to you from Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Tēnei ka mihi ke te mana whenua o Aotearoa. And we acknowledge the local tribal authorities of New Zealand.
And g'day, I'm Emma Strutt and I'm currently coming to you from Darrumbull country in Queensland. Before we dive into our conversation today, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. And finally, if you enjoy this potty, please subscribe, like, share or comment on our social media or consider buying us a coffee if you'd like to help support our work. Now on with the show.
The discovery of fire helped propel human civilizations from the Stone Age into the Bronze Age. Fast forward hundreds of thousands of years and many communities across Australia and even parts of New Zealand now consider fire as a threat. This is going to be one fascinating chat.
So today we are very lucky to be speaking with Associate Professor Luke Kelly from the University of Melbourne. Luke is an award-winning researcher interested in ecology and evolution, biodiversity conservation and environmental decision-making. Much of Luke's work is focused on understanding animal and plant responses to fire, landscape modification and climate change. And today we'll be discussing his new research, looking at how climate change is reshaping patterns of fire across the planet. So Luke, thank you so much for joining us today. It's going to be a very timely conversation considering how our fire season's shaping up.
Great. Thanks, Emma and Ben. I'm really excited to be chatting with you guys today.
Before we get straight into this quite broad conversation, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background and your interest in ecology and evolution and ultimately fire.
Great. So, well, I'm a scientist and I study plants and animals, and I really like finding out how ecosystems work and how we can conserve biodiversity. That means I get to do, you know, lots of really fun things. Like I get to travel around Australia and the world looking for different plants and animals, finding out where they are and how they're interacting with the landscape. I get to do lots of experiments using fires and other things, get to grow plants in greenhouses and look at how fast they grow. I get to work with lots of really interesting people around the world. A big part of what I do we call co-design, which means we do science with local communities and people involved in the plants and the animals we study and the decisions these are related to. I got into this caper of science because I really loved learning about animals. So I spent a lot of my early life chasing little mammals around forests and woodlands in Australia. And through that, I got an interest in science.
And I believe you head up a group called, I might be mispronouncing this, but Biodynamos, or I felt like saying Biodynamos. I don't know why, because you've got quite an international crew of people there. But tell us a little bit about that research group.
Yeah, the Biodynamos, the Biodiversity Dynamics Research Group. So we're a group at the University of Melbourne. And as in the name, we're interested in studying the dynamics of biodiversity or the diversity of life. We're a group of about 10 to 15 people. We collaborate with lots of others as well. We study plants and animals across Australia in all sorts of different ecosystems, whether it's the grasslands near Melbourne or the 90-metre mountain ash forests nearby us too. And our group is a collection of PhD students and master's students, as well as full-time researchers. And we like to work with just lots of different people around the world.
So we're here to talk shop on fire today. Let's just set the scene a little bit. I suppose in Australia, it's fair to say, as Ben alluded to in the intro, that many people see fire as a bit of a destructive force, especially after that 2019-2020 bushfire season. But the Earth wouldn't be as we know it today without fire. So before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty of your paper, maybe just give us some fire fundamentals. Like, why is fire so important to the Earth system and to us as humans?
Yeah, fantastic. So fire has been on Earth for about, you know, 420-odd million years. So ever since we've had plants or vascular plants on Earth, we've had fires. So it's been a big part of the development and the evolution of everything on our planet. Since then, people have gotten really good at using fire, and it's been a huge part of the evolution and the cultural evolution of people. So since about 400,000 years ago, there's pretty good evidence that humans or human ancestors have been using fire for all sorts of things, whether it's cooking or warmth in places like Africa and Europe. we're closer to home. In Australia, for example, people have been using fire for about 65,000 years or so, ever since people first arrived in Australia. And there's good oral traditions and knowledge that suggest that's the case, that people have been using fire, you know, right across the landscape for both hunting and agriculture and more recently pastoralism. So for about 12,000 years in Europe, there's really good evidence that people have also been using fire in a really sophisticated way to produce the kinds of plants and animals that we want and to make ecosystems good for people.
Talk to us a little bit about more about the ecosystem itself, the importance of fire for the earth, the
That's
soil,
right.
the plants and so on.
Yeah, so often we think about fire as maybe being a bad thing or a disaster, but lots of plants and animals and other things we care about have evolved under fire. And, you know, they not only deal with fire, but they thrive under recurrent patterns of fire or different patterns of fire. So things like, well, plants, for example, have all these amazing traits that help them regenerate after fire. Some plants can re-sprout after fire. Some plants need fire to actually stimulate flowering or to stimulate new growth. There's a really neat trait called serotiny, which some plants store their seeds high up in the canopy. And after a fire, they drop all their seeds into the ground. When those seeds drop into the ground, there's rich ash and nutrients for them to germinate into. And there's also reduced competition from other things that would otherwise be covering that landscape. So they get lots of nutrients and light and they can grow again. So lots of not only species, but ecosystems need, you know, the right kind of fire. And that's the trick, getting the right kind of fire rather than too much or too much fire or fires that are too big.
So let's talk about your recent paper then. You were lead author of Understanding Fire Regimes for a Better Anthropocene. Firstly, what were the main aims that you wanted to achieve by undertaking this review?
Yeah, well, all this really scary stuff is happening around the world. You know, the climate's changing rapidly, fire activity is changing rapidly, biodiversity is declining and we're in a crisis. And, you know, people aren't as healthy as they could be. So there's bad things happening and they're real and affecting the whole planet. But at the same time, there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of science that can help us do things better and address these problems and these crises. So we wanted to get together and, you know, take a cold, hard look at these problems, but also think, what do we know that's going to make a difference? And we use this term in the title, a better Anthropocene. And for some people, that's a little bit jarring because often we think of this term, the Anthropocene, which basically means like a human-dominated planet. We think of that as being a bad thing. And we wanted to sort of jolt people into thinking, well, maybe other things are possible, other ways of doing things are possible.
And before we get into what your findings were, this paper seems like a pretty huge undertaking. So how did you actually go about quantifying the fire changes and the variations?
Yep.
And like, I imagine there was a lot of data to comb through and there would have been some challenges along the way there.
That's right. The lots of challenges was also really fun. So the first part of it was just building a team to do it. So the authorship team in this case involved people from Australia and Europe, people that do, you know, what we might call Western science, but also people focused on Indigenous knowledge as well, people that know about plants and animals and soils and the atmosphere. So we had a team with really diverse knowledge, and that was a good starting point to think about ideas. What we did in this case was bring together information from lots of different types of science and lots of different disciplines. So rather than just look at, for example, satellite images on their own or maybe charcoal records in the ground on their own, what we wanted to do was bring together all these different kinds of evidence from global satellites to archaeological records to written records from Indigenous peoples or people working with Indigenous peoples right around the world. So we brought together and gathered a whole lot of evidence about how fires are changing in different ways. And that's really important because different forms of evidence have their pros and cons, essentially. We have really good satellite data from, you know, the late 70s, especially the last couple of decades, but that only tells us a part of the story. So we essentially need to, you know, dig deeper to really understand how things are changing. And some of these fields, you know, literally dig deeper by revealing, you know, the material record in the soil, or by giving us traces of how fires influenced the soil and their residue. And that allows us to think about fires over, you know, not just centuries, but over thousands of years. So what we did was bring all of this together, and that was a big undertaking.
So to start teasing out some of the key findings, were there any preconceptions that you went, I mean, as a scientist, you need to be removed and go in open-minded, but naturally you'll have some preconceived thoughts or expectations of what you get from a research, an outcome. Were some of them surprises to you, or kind of busted some of those myths, or you know, anything like that? Any surprises?
Lots of surprises. So one really interesting thing about all of these changes across the globe is that it's not as simple as, you know, we're getting more fire or we're getting hotter fires. There's lots of different things happening around the world. And actually, when we look at a global scale, the activity of fires is actually reducing. And especially over the last couple of decades, we're getting less fire at a global scale than in some of the records we have, which is really interesting. But the trick is thinking about what we mean by fire. And scientists use this really, it's a bit of a jargony term, but we call it fire regimes. And what that really means is having different ways of describing fire, whether it's how frequently fires burn, how big they are, how hot they're burning, how patchy they are. So that nuance in describing fires is really important to think about then, how is the world changing? Because fire isn't just one uniform thing, it's all these different things. And when we start to look at the size of fires or how hot they are, which we sometimes call intensity, that's where we can start to talk about some of these patterns in a way that helps us make sense of the world. So to get back to your original question, what was a surprise? One is that fire activity is declining across the globe, but that doesn't necessarily mean that in places such as Australia or North America or Canada, the fires aren't on the increase, because they definitely are. But what's happening is in places like Africa, so in Tanzania, and even parts of Brazil, we're having less fires in ecosystems that perhaps need those fires, like grasslands and savannas. And when we measure things right across the globe, we see that decline. So it's really interesting to pick that apart and think about what that means for different parts of the world.
And what about locally then in Australia? You mentioned it's not following the global trend. Of course, Australia is very large. We've got different types of vegetation and fuel types throughout different areas. But any clear changes or trends that we need to unpack here?
Yeah, so really, really huge changes in Australia, especially in Australian forests. And there's a clear upward trend in what we call like megafires or megafire years. We use this term megafire. Sometimes it means, you know, fires that are about a million hectares. So these are really big fires. And we're getting more and more of these over the last 40 years or so. And that's really clear when we look at satellite records and mapping right across Australian forests. Another unusual thing that's happening in Australia is some of the forests that are burning are not forests that we've observed to burn in the past. So Queensland's a good example, where there's rainforests that are burning that don't typically burn. Whereas the changes in southern Australia, the forests in southern Australia often burn, but they're burning more now than they have in the last 40 years or so.
Now, can we clarify one thing? This study, and in general, most of your studies, does this take into account man-made fires as well?
Yes. Yes, that's right. And it's interesting because most fires are, well, there's interrelationships between what we might call wildfires or bushfires in Australia and all the sorts of different fires that people ignite, whether we call it planned burning or cultural burning, and they're done for lots of different reasons, to reduce fuel or to promote desirable plants and animals. So what we found when we looked at the scale of fire across the globe was at about 3.98 million square kilometres burns every year. So that's including wildfires and human-started fires. So that's about, you know, 3% of the land surface of the earth is burning every year. So this is a substantial thing.
And this is interesting because on a recent trip back from Vancouver, I sat next to a team of Kiwi firefighters that had been over there fighting fires in northern British Columbia. And their observation, and the gentleman that I sat next to on the flight back, he's been doing it for years, for almost two decades. And he was saying how much more they are fighting. Like the size of, you know, the amount of land that is now being covered by fires. So there's the man-made aspect, but there's also, you know, you talk about, you know, some areas that are not burning that should or shouldn't be burning, but are. There's other forces at play, aren't there? It's not just there's a fire here, there'll be another fire next year. There's other contributing factors. So let's talk a little bit about what creates, do we say, the perfect environment for a fire, or what causes these, putting man-made aside in terms of lighting a match or land clearing for crops and so on?
Yeah, good question. So people influence fires in a number of ways. Scientists have this really neat way of thinking about it in terms of what we call like four switches. So four things that need to be activated for fire to occur. And basically we need fuel, we need dry fuel, we need ignitions, and we need weather to spread that fire. And we get all of those things switched on at the same time. That's when we get fires. And we influence all those switches in lots of different ways. One way is by how we use the land, whether it's through agriculture or forestry or creating cities and urban areas. You know, that changes the mix of fuels in a place. And in some places, how we use the land is increasing the amount of fuel or the availability of that fuel. Another way that we influence the land is through mixing up which species are where. And we do that by transporting, you know, for example, invasive grasses around the world, which are increasing flammability in places like Northern Australia or in Hawaii, for example, where there's been really big and devastating fires recently. We can also influence the mix of species by causing things to go extinct. So in Australia, we've removed lots of little digging animals from the landscape, and those little digging animals were really important in integrating fuels into the soil and reducing and moderating fuels. In Africa, things like the extinction of white rhinos is shifting vegetation and making some areas more flammable as well. A really big thing, though, is how we influence the climate. And we're pumping so many greenhouse gases into the climate that we're in a really unusual space at the moment. So I was just reading a paper this morning where they looked at climate records going back tens of thousands of years. And the period from July to August was essentially the hottest period on record. And, you know, there was a day in July or August, which was across the globe, you know, the hottest day in the last 100,000 years. And that influences the availability of fuels, dries fuels out. It also influences fire weather, which is contributing to all of these changes. But importantly, all these changes in the land, these changes in climate, these changes in the mix of species, they're all propelled by big social changes, things like industrialization, or in, you know, Australia and South America and North America, cessation of indigenous burning, for example. All these big changes have these flow-on effects for the land and the plants and animals we care about, and patterns of fires that we're starting to see.
One of the things that I found really interesting in your paper, or super depressing, depending on which way you want to look at it, you've already mentioned it, but the extinction of species. So like you mentioned in your paper that 37 species have recently gone extinct because of these modified fire activities. But the marsupials in Australia that, you know, foraged the soil and the leaf litter could have moderated the fire regime. So that's just one example of a potential like positive feedback loop that could be occurring and compounding the negative outcomes.
Yeah, that's right. All these feedbacks are really important to understand. In some other recent work, we took a look across the globe at, you know, how many species might be threatened by these changes in fires. And it's more than about 4,000 species across the globe, plants, animals, and other things, are threatened by these changes in fire. Mostly it's, you know, too much fire or fires that are too hot, but sometimes it's these species, you know, not getting enough of the right kind of fire. And of the species that are already extinct, in addition to this 4,000 odd, you know, you're quite right. So the removal of those species can then change, you know, whether animals are digging things, contributing to ecosystems. We sometimes call them ecosystem engineers because they play a really important part. And when we take them out of the system, we can get more fuels developing and more fires. It's tricky because there's different things can happen in different places. So in some cases, putting these digging animals back or even grazing animals can then help moderate fire. But in other places, there are calls to promote grazing in ecosystems where the grazing itself could actually cause more fires, because things like cows in Australian alpine areas, for example, eat lots of really plants that are more fireproof. So plants that hold lots of water, for example. And so when we try to put things back that shouldn't be there, we can actually stuff things up a little bit. So there's some interesting things to think through there.
And then on the flip side, because you mentioned globally there's been that decrease, are there any animals, flora, fauna, that are at risk because of the lack of fire in an area?
Yeah, that's right. And that was a really surprising thing from some new work that we did, where we looked at Australian mammals, for example. There's about 100 threatened mammals in Australia, which is, it's kind of crazy to say out loud because it's really concerning. And about 88% of those mammals are threatened by changes in fire regimes. Again, the big severe fires are a concern for most, but there's about 20 odd species that actually could do with a bit more fire, or more of the right kind of fire, so patchy fires. I work on this really beautiful little native rodent called Bolam's mouse in the arid zone. And they are a big fat-headed mouse, and they really love recently burnt areas. Often when we get burnt areas, especially combined with high rainfall, we get a flush of new growth of grass and seeds and food availability. And these little guys, the Bolam's mouse, do quite well in that landscape. And they also have the ability to dig burrows. So they live in burrows. So they don't need necessarily standing vegetation to build nests in or shelter in. So they do quite well in these post-fire environments, as long as there's not too many cats and foxes around to gobble them up.
Going back to the various drivers of these regime changes and effectively causes of fires, is there an understanding of what is now the bigger drivers, the bigger causes of it, and how that's actually changed over time? So one would presume that climate change is becoming a more prevalent factor, whereas some might become less. So is there a pattern?
Yes. So people, like I said at the start, people have been modifying fires and landscapes for a very long time, since people evolved in fire-prone landscapes in Africa. And that's included using fire in a really skillful and sophisticated way for tens of thousands of years. So what's new here isn't that we're reshaping fire, it's that all these things are coming together at once and combining. So things like climate change and deforestation and invasive species are all amplifying. They're coming together at once, they're interacting, and they're creating, you know, new landscapes in this Anthropocene. The climate one is a really big one, and some of the other changes are modifying fuels. So whether it's forestry or agriculture or land clearing or putting new species in places. But the climate thing is happening over the top of that. And some of the fires that we're seeing at the moment aren't necessarily fuel limited, but it's climate is a key driver. And there's a really clear signal for that.
So with all of these factors coming together to create almost the perfect storm, at least within Australia, obviously there's going to be flow-on effects for flora, fauna, for humans. So what are some of the main consequences that we've already seen? What can we potentially expect moving forward with these changing fire regimes?
Yeah, so what's happening is that these changes in fire change what we might call like the whole Earth system. So the biosphere, the geosphere, so the soil, the atmosphere, the air we breathe, and these changes are all connected. So fires influence the atmosphere by, you know, producing, you know, aerosols and carbon emissions. And after the big fires in 2019 and 2020 in Australia, what we sometimes call the Black Summer fires, we had, you know, record levels of aerosols shooting up into the stratosphere. You know, the smoke plumes from those fires carried all the way to the Southern Ocean, and that resulted in blooms of phytoplankton, you know, tens of thousands of kilometres away. So all these changes are connected. You know, there's big changes in the water as well. So fires transport nutrients into rivers, which and eventually the rivers find themselves into the ocean as well, connecting things up, often reducing the quality of water. In places like North America, where snowpack and snow is better understood, we can see already that fires are reducing the amount of snow in different places. And the fires are actually creeping higher and higher up into the landscape as well as the climate warms. So again, big changes. And you know, of course, really big changes for us, for people. Massive loss of life from recent fires. The wildfires, again, in 2019, 2020 in Australia, killed about 34 people directly. Some of the estimates in terms of, you know, premature deaths from things like smoke in the atmosphere are that more than 400 people died prematurely, and that there are an extra, you know, 3,000 or so hospital visits relating to, you know, respiratory disorders and things like that. So it's having a big influence, you know, on us and the whole planet.
And then the mental health consequences of the communities needing to then rebuild from what they've been through.
That's right. And you know, so many people in Australia and lots of other people have, you know, direct experiences with fire now. I just spent the last week or so in Montreal talking to people about the 18 million hectares of forests that have burnt in Canada and their experiences with the fires. And even, you know, places like Montreal and New York, you know, swamped with reduced air quality and smoke. Lots of people probably seen the photos of these. But talking to my colleagues and Indigenous leaders over there, you know, on all sorts of different communities, these impacts are influencing people's, you know, mental health and physical health.
Talk about all these global hotspots. Where does Australia actually, is there a ranking where it's worse, where the bigger impacts are, where the greater rates of risk of extinction of species, where the greater risk to personal health and life and so on? Is there some form of assessment of that, where some areas are just worse to be in?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, in terms of biodiversity, Australia is a hotspot for biodiversity decline. You know, I mentioned before there's about 100 mammal species that are threatened with extinction, so either endangered, critically endangered, or vulnerable to extinction. Fires having a huge influence on that, and lots of other species, birds, reptiles, the whole shebang, unfortunately. In terms of where fire is having the biggest influence, it's often where there's highly populated areas. So urban areas, in and around Sydney and Melbourne and other areas are becoming more flammable, and people are moving into more flammable landscapes and living there. Similar things are happening in California. I lived in Spain for 3 years, and similar things are happening there on the verges of places like Barcelona. So those high-risk areas are where we have, you know, lots of fuels, changes in climate happening at the same time. Again, all these switches coming on and people there. Sometimes people igniting these fires deliberately. Sometimes these fires starting by lightning and people just being, you know, right at the front of them.
So that brings us to the question then of how we coexist with fire in this Anthropocene that we find ourselves in. So how do we best manage this situation and try to move forward while considering, you know, the human health aspects and the health of the planet in the face of all of these changing fire patterns?
Yeah, that's a huge question, and it takes up a lot of my time thinking about this. One thing I'd say right from the start is that I think there's really like exciting opportunities to try new things and experiment a bit. You know, the whole world has been transformed, and what we're doing now, that's not working. And so we need to be bold and try new things together. And before I talk about the different actions, I think I really want to emphasize that word together, like different communities, different peoples, different groups working together to generate ideas. Because I think too often there's sort of conflict around what do we do next, whether we're thinking about biodiversity or fire or even other issues. And I think, you know, in Australia and New Zealand and lots of other places, we're at our best when we work together to create solutions, I think. So some of these kinds of solutions are looking for things that benefit both people and nature. And one of these is doing patchy burns in different places. I work in a place called the Mallee in semi-arid Australia, and we've been studying the plants and animals there for more than a decade. And we've been doing experiments with local government agencies responsible for managing fire, where they burn different kinds of fires, some really big uniform ones or some really patchy. And we go into those fires and we find out what kind of plants and animals are living in these places. And what we find is when there's patchy plan burns, which are often done to reduce the size of really big fires that might occur, what we find is there's lots of little mammals and reptiles living in these refuges that the people doing the plan burns leave in the landscape. So a really important way forward is to think about these different kinds of fires, and patchy fires can be good for a lot of aspects of biodiversity.
Is that similar to the mosaic burning techniques that Indigenous Australians undertake?
Yeah, so we have lots of different words for these patchy fires, where they create mosaics of different patterns. Now, the mosaics created by plan burning from government agencies are often a bit different to the kinds of burning done by Indigenous peoples. They're probably a little bit bigger and also done for different reasons. But there is a similarity in the sense that it's trying to, look after the land. Indigenous burning, had happened in Australia for, more than 60,000 years and lots of other places, often in a very skillful and sophisticated way, but often involving decisions at a very local scale. So thinking about, what's happening around this particular tree or this little food resource or this patch. So very careful decisions made across very large scales. And I think we need to get back to something like that. So rather than looking at very coarse maps and trying to make decisions based on that, we need people that really know their plants and their animals and the local landscape to get that right kind of fire. And that's something that's really exciting that's happening right now, is Indigenous knowledge holders and Indigenous fire practitioners coming together with people with maybe like fire operations experience that are involved in like firefighting and other kinds of, plan burning, along with local communities, with all kinds of backgrounds and scientists. So that coming together of knowledge is, it's just so important, but it's also, really exciting. I live in a little town in the west of Melbourne on Wurundjeri country. And in my town, we hadn't had Indigenous burning for about 150 years. But a really nice thing, and this happened during the COVID lockdowns, was the local community got together with the Wurundjeri people, so the traditional custodians of the land, and they burnt one of the little reserves in a cultural burn. And that cultural burn sparked a regeneration of lots of beautiful and amazing grasses. Lots of cockatoos and lots of birds came in and fed in that landscape. So I got to walk my kids every day to school, and we got to talk about, here's this cultural burn, here's people coming together, here's this amazing biodiversity. And, my whole community just felt really good about that. It was a really good thing.
So from a more practical point of view, what would your recommendation be for people or communities that live in more vulnerable areas? You've spoken about cultural burn, but is there also, sometimes there's the inevitable. There is going to be fire. It's going to be aggressive. What can these communities do to better protect themselves as well as the biodiversity around them, the nature, the animals, the plants, etc.?
Yeah, a really important thing to consider is like where people live and tailoring the fire management, solutions and actions to that particular area. So it matters a lot whether you're living next to a grassland or a dry forest or a wet forest or a rainforest. In some of those cases, you might put your energy into, putting out fires, and other places, burning and reducing fuels might be more appropriate. One really cool thing that's happening around the world, and actually that people in New Zealand are leading right now, is this idea of creating green fire breaks. So these are areas of, reduced fuels, but that also maintain some habitats for different plants and animals in the landscape. So this term green fire breaks can mean lots of different things, and that's where it's important to talk about local communities about what that means. In some areas, it might mean keeping big, large trees in the landscape, but reducing fuels or mowing around those trees. So there's still these trees in the landscape providing habitat for things like birds or koalas, depending on where you live, or other things that live in the trees. But you take out some of the connectivity of that fuel. You know, we can create parklands that look like that as well. And in New Zealand, people are trying different food plants as well. They call it fighting fire with food. So there's some really neat stuff going on. You know, further afield in China, for example, they've planted about 360,000 kilometres of what they call green fire breaks, which are like, in this case, low flammability tree species. So trees that don't burn very easily, and if they're strategically located in the landscape, they can sort of act as a bit of a barrier when fires occur. They won't stop every fire, but they might help to moderate them and reduce the severity and spread of them.
And just a bit of a plug for, you know, like the state fire and emergency services, they'll usually have a downloadable PDF with some of these tips and tricks for people who do live in high-risk areas. So have a download and have a read.
Yeah, that's great. And it's people can do a lot around their homes and their properties as well. You know, both to boost biodiversity, but also to, you know, reduce fuels and the risk of their houses going up in flames. And some really good research, you know, shows that the properties that reduce fuels right next to their houses, that makes a big difference during a wildfire to the safety of people in their homes.
So if there was a new portfolio created tomorrow and you were given the position of, you know, Minister for Fire Management, and of course everything you ever suggest would get passed with no problems, what would you love to see done at a government level? Like, we've talked about the community action and the grassroots action that can occur, but what would you love to see, you know, Aussie, New Zealand governments initiating?
One thing we know is that, like, often what's good for biodiversity is good for people and vice versa. So, you know, healthy ecosystems mean healthy people. So I would start, you know, restoring ecosystems and helping them adapt to the changes that come. So that means putting in place actions that reduce the number of threatened and endangered species. So that would mean, you know, stopping land clearing, controlling invasive plants and animals. That helps to boost the resilience of the whole ecosystem, as well as doing things like making sure we have lots of big, large trees where they're needed. When ecosystems are more resilient, when we have things like fire, they recover quicker because the plants and animals sort of know what to do in that context. They're adapted to fires. So when they're healthy and get hit by fire, they bounce back a lot quicker. So creating resilient ecosystems is a really key one. Of course, we need to put lots of resources into stopping fires and suppressing fires as well. That's still really important, especially as the climate changes. So detecting fires really early on so we can essentially pounce at them before they get out of control is really important as well.
So as powerful as fire is, it isn't something we need to be fearful of. It's something we need to better understand, respect, and appreciate that it actually has a place on for a healthy planet. But it's just more about how we navigate around the changing landscape, so to speak, with the high vulnerability of unwanted fires, but also how to better prepare and adapt when it does happen. So there's a lot more, fair to say, education to happen across grassroots level, but all the way up to, as Emma suggested, government level to better manage this.
Yeah, that's right. I think one thing that's going to be important is going beyond just seeing fires as a disaster or some event that we're surprised by. We're always sort of just reacting to fires. But we can plan for these things, and we can, in doing so, we can make the world a much better place. And look, tens of thousands of people around the world, hundreds of thousands of people around the world are planning for this, and there are great things happening. You know, I mentioned I was just in Canada. There, at the same time, there are also 600 Australian firefighters in Canada helping them deal with these wildfires. So there's collaboration and engagement right around the world. So there's good things happening. But we need to go beyond just reacting to these fires to being really proactive. And I think if we're going to address these problems, that's one of the main things that we need to do. And that's not just a theoretical thing. That means actually putting into place plans that allow us to deal with these changes as they arise. So having good plans for putting out fires, having good plans for introducing fires where we might need more of them, making sure communities are prepared, whether it's local communities or statewide or national communities or even global communities. But as I said right at the start, the important thing, I think, is that we just get lots of people together talking about these ideas and generating more and more ideas for, you know, alternative actions we can enact.
And keeping that positive thread going, you've already kind of talked to this in a roundabout way, but the UN Sustainable Development Goals, they're kind of seen as a blueprint for a better and more sustainable future by some people. Now, they don't specifically mention fire, but fire and how we manage it obviously connects to all of them, and you've outlined that in your paper in detail. I don't expect you to go through that line by line or anything, but with some positive parting messages, I suppose, how do you feel that fire can help us achieve those goals and move towards a more sustainable future?
Yeah, great. So, you know, the 17 Sustainability Development Goals are really important. They're great goals, and they're also very globally influential in helping us get together and solve different kinds of problems. And fire has been missing from these, but I would reason that we need to understand fire to really make a go of all of these goals. Every one of these 17 goals, we need to understand fire in some way to achieve them. We've talked a bit about, you know, fire and, you know, life on land or biodiversity. I think that's a common way that we might think about fire. That's a clear way, you know, we might use fire to stimulate different plants and animals and organise threatened species. But it's much more than that. So the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, relate to things like, you know, sustainable cities. And, you know, I talked about green fire breaks before. That's a great way we can achieve sustainable cities. Other things like, you know, the amount of food that people have. Again, people have been using fire to create food plants and food resources for thousands of years. And that's still, you know, right around the world for thousands of Indigenous groups, as well as local farmers in different communities, you know, using fire is a really important part of getting enough food and not being too hungry. You know, perhaps surprisingly, even things like gender equality, fire can play an important part by, for example, empowering different groups and different groups of women to be able to use and practice fire in a way that they want to. So there's lots of different kinds of goals. One more might be thinking about, you know, the economy and fire. So wildfires cause billions of dollars of damage to the fire, but on a more positive note, in places like Africa, Tanzania, again, promoting the right kind of fire can actually help lots of charismatic animals like zebras and wildebeest that people want to go and see. So it can benefit tourism, and that brings in money for local people, and it's good for biodiversity, it's good for people. There's lots of other examples too.
Amazing. Associate Professor Luke Kelly, this has been a hugely insightful conversation. So thank you so much for sharing your passion and knowledge about this very important topic as we head into our summer months here in Australia and New Zealand. Thank you for coming onto the show.
Thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun and really interesting.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.